Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in business into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Hello and welcome to the EDH Reccast. My name is Joey Schultz and I'm joined, as always, by my fantastic co-hosts. Up first, when he wins an award, he doesn't just thank the Academy, he thanks the Tolarian Academy. It's Matt Morgan.
So Joey, there was one time I went on a first date and I invited this nice young woman to meet me at the gym and she didn't show up and it kind of was weird, but I knew things weren't going to work out.
Oh, no. Now, Matt, okay.
There's a lot of layers to that joke. I get it. You can just pick it up and put it right back down.
Okay, I see what you did. People feel like I am fake when I laugh at your dad jokes, but I think all of those folks out there who think that I'm just like being insincere with my laughter at your dad jokes are missing the point. What this is clearly Stockholm Syndrome. I can't escape from your dad jokes, so I might as well enjoy myself.
I think it's more like a chuckling scoff than actual laughter.
It's either that or I break my nose from face palming too hard every week, you know?
Yes, that too.
Oh, goodness. All right. Up next, he just saw the commander designs for the new Warhammer decks, and he's wondering what in the brawl is going on over there. It's Dana Roach.
I went to a wedding last weekend. It was actually pretty beautiful. Even the cake was in tears.
Dang it. All right. So, yep.
Because there was...
You got to grin and bear it. That's just the way it is. Otherwise, I'll facepalm too much. I love you guys. Thank you. Thank you, Dana. Thank you for that.
I'm glad to help.
I appreciate it. Anyway, this is the EDH Rec cast. Let's just get on with ourselves.
There it is.
EDH Rec is the best deck building resource on the web for the commander format, compiling data from deck lists all over the internet to provide helpful recommendations for new commander decks. And here on the podcast, we love to give that data a little more context. Matt, do you mind telling us what it is that we are talking about in this week's episode?
Well, this week we're going to talk about decks that like to dirtle, maybe a little too much, and have problems just from a deck building perspective when it comes to closing out games.
Yeah, yeah. Decks that dirtly commander decks is kind of an interesting thing. Maybe this is a conflict that we have in our own deck building. Maybe it's a thing that we've played a lot. It'll be interesting to explore to make sure that your decks are not just spinning their wheels, but that they're actually definitely going somewhere. So that'll be a whole lot of fun. But before we get into that, we've got a couple of quick shout outs to do.
First, we'd like to thank Chase, also known as Mana Curves, for their work editing the show. You can find them on Twitter at Mana Curves.
And you can support the show by liking, subscribing these videos on YouTube, subscribing in your podcast app. But also you can do so over at patreon.com/EDHRecCast, where we have patron tiers of all levels. Whether you want to see all of our historic challenges, stats, picks, you want to see the episodes a day early, there's all that and more, including the very special patron shout out, which you can get just by going to patreon.com/EDHRecCast. And this week, we're giving a very special thank you to Sylvia Krause. So thank you so much. It's not sauerkraut, which is good because we can like you more for that.
Oh, do you not like sauerkraut?
At all. That's
how
disgusting.
Dare you?
Do you like it?
It's fine.
We're getting a new host. You have to hate that stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if I can accept that. It's pretty horrifying.
Thank you, Sylvia, for outing Joey. Thank you for outing Joey as liking sauerkraut, which is absolutely disgusting. Don't at me.
I'm sauerkraut ambivalent, okay? I neither love nor hate it, but I do love our patrons, including you, Sylvia. Thank you for the support. Matt, you are so weird. Okay, let's just get right to our main topic, because we're off to a weird start. All right. We are talking about Dirtly Commander decks. Decks that will probably like take a lot of game actions, or they'll do a lot. You have to jump through a lot of hoops, but they might not actually, once you're done with the turn, maybe they didn't go necessarily too far. Or Matt, I like the way that you said it, that maybe these are decks that might struggle to actually close a game out. Could be another way to look at it as well. So how about we just pass this right off to you? When we're talking about dirtily commander decks, or dirtle decks in general, I guess, what is the thing that comes to mind? How do you approach this topic, basically?
Well, I guess we should probably define dirtly, because it's something very specific, I would say, to Magic the Gathering and board games in general. But when we say dirtly decks, we mean decks that kind of sit around. They do a lot of things, but they're not necessarily trying to win the game at any given step. Brago decks are kind of renowned for this. They accrue a whole bunch of value. They get a whole bunch of things going, but it doesn't actually help to win the game because there's so many just different game actions that maybe they're getting their own little benefits, but they're not actually moving the game state forward in a way that's going to cause it to end anytime soon.
Okay.
These decks also tend to be good, I guess, is the point. Like, because there's plenty of bad decks that don't advance the game, so either maybe yes. do things. We're going to tend to focus on commanders that are actually effective. They generate value. They have the ability to affect the game. They just have a difficult time turning that corner and actually closing things out. And I think that's an important distinction.
Mm. Or maybe they never turn the corner, which is my biggest beef with some of these types of decks.
Yeah.
No, that is definitely a good distinction. And I think it's probably really easy for us to contrast against other commanders that, like, it's really easy to recognize commanders that come out and make an immediate impact as soon as they hit the field. Like Maelstrom Wanderer, for example. Like, that is not going to be in any way a dirtly commander, because you get two cascades as soon as you play it. The battlefield looks different as soon as you cast that card. And it definitely is pushing things forward as soon as you cast that card. And they're a little bit more brazen, a little more out there. Whereas some of the dirtly decks, like the value, you'll get a lot of value. But Matt, a refrain that I know you've said a couple of times on the podcast before is that value isn't victory. So these might be commanders that accrue a lot of value, but is that value actually helping you win anytime soon? Not necessarily. So you have to put a lot of extra thought into, okay, how's this deck actually going to close things down?
Yeah, it's there's a lot of decks out there. We're going to cover a few of them, but it's not really even necessarily attached to a certain command or strategy, because obviously you can build decks however you want, but just what we see on EDH Rec, what the typical deck looks like, that's kind of what we're going to focus on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we mentioned Brago, and actually, Dana, I know that you have some of the most experience playing with and against Brago. That's a very famous Blink commander. Do you have thoughts about that one being sort of a dirtly commander?
Yeah, because my friend Max, who pilots the deck, will be the first person to admit it's a struggle trying to figure out how to close out games with that deck, other than just hoping you can continuously smack someone in the face with that Muldrifter that you're casting just so you can blink it and draw a couple cards. Because Brago is basically a creature that when you connect with Brago, when you deal combat damage, you can temporarily exile a permanent you control and then bring it back into play. So basically, you're going to run a bunch of things with Enter the Battlefield abilities and try to trigger them by hitting somebody with Brago. Mm. The problem is they like tend to not attach useful Enter the Battlefield abilities onto, like, you know, 6/6 flyers or something that are efficiently costed. So you're going to eventually probably chip away at people's life total with those creatures, but like that can take forever in that style of deck. So you need to find other ways to win. And the way that deck tends to be constructed makes it difficult to combine those two things, combine the value you want to generate with a way to actually close out the game.
Right.
Well, and I think the most egregious part about Brago King Eternal is, like you said, Dana, it exiles things, but it's not just a target permanent. It's any number of non-land permanents that you control.
Yeah.
So Brago players are able to blink their entire board, which not only creates a whole bunch of triggers, but it just takes forever for these decks to resolve. If you have an Aether Channeler, one of those new cards from Dominaria United, you have three options of what you can do when that card enters the battlefield. If you have OG Exquisite Blade, all of a sudden you're scrying a bunch, you're probably drawing some cards. You have all sorts of things going on, and these decks are very, very good at getting a lot of value, but it's finding ways to convert that value into meaningful game actions that are going to help you win the game.
Yeah, honestly, I would probably say that like blink decks generally sort of struggle with this. I think like a lot of the things that you want to repeat over and over again are those Moldrifters, are those Cloud Blazers where you can draw a bunch of cards as they repeatedly enter, leave, and that is really good. Like you'll have more options. It's going to help you stay in the game, but they are, you know, if you're just chipping away in the air, that's not necessarily realistic. Like another one that comes to, not realistic as a way to like close the game out in a proper amount of time, where you're not giving your opponents extra turns that they might be able to catch you out and actually like overcome your commanding lead at that point. But another example that comes to my mind here, especially, would be like Ranar the Everwatchful, which is another Azorius commander that cares about blink and foretell. And it makes you a bunch of tokens as a result of that. And that's a really cool effect. But again, it's just a bunch of 1/1 flying tokens. And you would need to make a lot of those before you have what I would call a reasonable win condition in play. And I think as a result of that, something that we see, especially in blink decks, is that a lot of players seem to default to like infinite combos as a way to finally close things down. Like Brago is famous for having an infinite combo with Stryonic Resonator, where you can repeatedly do those effects over and over again. And that is, in fact, going to make you like infinite creatures on board so that you do have a lethal next turn. And infinite combos are sometimes a bit of a touchy point amongst commander players, but I mean, I guess I'll say that I would prefer like a combo like that happens to make the game close down as opposed to the game takes, you know, another hour for the deck to finally win. So that's where I'm at.
I mean, it definitely beats dying to a Moldrift for over the course of 20 turns.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's 20 turns per person too. So you're, have the Moldrifter, but you have three other players you have to take out. And so, yeah, it's a lot of times you're just able to find your combos super quick. So it kind of becomes the meta for a lot of these decks where you're able to get so much value and draw so many cards in a lot of these decks. You just find your combo fairly reliable every single game. So that just becomes the easiest way to actually close it out because you have so much value engine built into the rest of the deck.
And one thing that I think we will notice as we talk about the different decks that tend to do this is they all tend to have to devote a significant amount of their deck building resources to doing whatever that strategy is. And those resources then don't necessarily lend themselves to a win condition. So you have to run a bunch of creatures that blink, that have ETB in your Brago deck, and you probably want to have other things to facilitate that, wave to protect that whole thing. That doesn't necessarily leave you a ton of room for putting in ways to win games because those require separate cards.
Right.
Sometimes you're lucky enough that your deck doesn't necessarily require separate cards to win. I you know, Brago's an Azorius deck. I have an Azorius Sphinx Tribal deck that does kind of play a little bit of control, not dissimilar to a Brago deck. It just so happens that I have 20 creatures in that deck that are all evasive 6/6 beaters that also generate me, you know, card draw similar to a Brago deck. So like in that situation, I don't need to necessarily worry about dirtling because I am fortunate enough that the way that deck is constructed, I have a win condition baked into every one of those bodies kind of in a way that a Brago deck doesn't. It's much easier to kill somebody with a handful of Sphinxes that I can maybe give double strike to than it is to giving a Muldrift for double strike.
No, yeah, absolutely. I think especially the fact that like there are a lot of players, probably more experienced players, who will be used to seeing some of these commanders and know that they tend to default to something like an infinite combo. So there might be players who sit down against your blink deck who are expecting you to combo. And if that's just the thing that you ought to be prepared for, that's the thing that you ought to be aware of, is that like sometimes that's why that perception will be there, even if that wasn't a thing that you were planning to do. But this definitely requires a lot of extra thought to be put into, okay, what are definitely the win conditions of this deck going to be? Blink decks, I think, are probably one of the strongest examples that we'll have of a very obviously dirtly commander, but there are plenty more. Like, another one that comes to my mind would be, like, Gavi Nest Warden, for example. That's the Jeskai Cycling commander. And it's really fun to do a bunch of cycling stuff, but that is a lot of drawing and discarding and a lot of drawing and discarding and then a lot of trying to get your second draw step every turn and a lot of Afar, God of the Poldis, and a whole bunch of other strange interactions with cycling cards just so that you can make a 2/2 cat creature token.
Yeah, Gavi Nest Warden is kind of like the Angie Falcon Wrath type of deck where you go so hard on one theme, whether it's cycling or madness or whatever, that the rest of the deck ends up being air because you're so focused on trying to do that one thing, which is why, you know, the Angie Falcon Wrath decks end up having that famous World Gorger Animate Dead combo in there because you're just so concentrated. You have to have something that's going to be able to win because madness cards, call me crazy, aren't really great at being able to win games for you.
Right. In both of those cases, you have to choose, you have to be very, very careful about the things that you are selecting for what your win conditions will be. Like for me, for example, in both of the decks we just named, Gavi and Anya Falconwrath, I would say, excuse me, Miss Angie, that's the official pronunciation. It's like Psychosis Crawler is one of the first things that jumps to my mind. I'd be so excited to play something like that. Or Brawlin, Skyshark Rider for both of those decks would also be awesome because as you discard a bunch of cards, you're dealing more damage. But like, those win conditions kind of run out pretty fast. You have to like hope that you find those soon so that the rest of the deck can actually like, okay, this will pull off into victory. You have to find a way to like make those things lethal. And the obvious ones might be obvious, but there also might be fewer of them than you initially think. So maybe you have to branch out a little bit more and see what else is going to be out there for you to actually find the realistic win conditions that are dense enough to be to see them in the games in a timely fashion.
That's really what it comes down to, is like finding a way to have not just one, but like multiple win conditions in these decks and find space for them while the deck is also, while you still have enough cards to do what you're trying to make the deck do as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dana, as you mentioned earlier, like we've mentioned examples of like Brago, which we know is good, and Gavi is certainly very popular too. But like you mentioned that these aren't just like, oh, you know, it's doing a lot and not going very far because the commander is bad. Not at all. Like, and I think our next example will be like the peak example of this, but like, I would wager that Muldrotha qualifies as potentially a very dirtily commander. And that is clearly also one of the more busto commanders we've seen. Like that one's really, really good and also very popular. Like I feel like that also qualifies as dirtle, probably depending on how it's built, or it has a risk of being built to be dirtily unless you're being attentive to it. Does that track with you, do you think?
It tracks, and it also, I guess this is as good a time as any to mention one component of this as well is these things all tend to be a little bit time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do they not necessarily have an easy way to generate that win for you, they take up actually like physical time for you to do all the things you're doing. You're playing your Muldrotha deck. Okay, I can cast multiple things from the graveyard this turn. Which of those things do I want to cast? How can I sequence them? What am I going to sacrifice to get back in the graveyard so I can do it next turn? How can I protect that graveyard from a Bajuka bug effect or something? Like, there's a lot of things going on that you have to position and maintain that don't necessarily bring you closer to winning the game.
Yeah, what Dana joked about, you know, the Muldrifter beats. It's going to take 20 turns to do that. Glenalender Archmage is the same thing. It's also a 2/2.
Yeah,
and
right.
You're going to get so much value. Or Ravenous Chupacabra. They're right. Great cards, but they're not necessarily proactive cards. They're just, they're reactive. They're adjusting. But also, they take a lot of time to resolve. Dana's absolutely right. These can be very time-consuming on the watch decks.
I feel like also a characteristic of some of these dirtily decks is that they're very good at not losing, which is different than being very good at winning. Like Muldrotha and Marin of Clan Nal'Toth, although I think, I'm not sure that I would qualify Marin as being dirtly necessarily, but both of those commanders are famous for Spore Frog recursion. Like you're constantly returning to the field this thing that you can sacrifice to make sure that you don't take combat damage. And that is going to, or Glacial Chasm. Like Muldrotha can also get back that land that prevents you from taking damage. It is hard to break through those, especially when any attempt to destroy those things means that Muldrotha is just going to get them right back the very next turn. Those are hard to break through, but they're also like definitely not winning the game at all. But it's hard to kill as well. Like these are resilient decks is a characteristic of dirtly decks, I think.
Oh yeah, very much so. In you know, it's probably not a coincidence that a handful of the ones we've talked about are also playing blue. So not only are they resilient and not only do they generate plenty of resources, in a lot of cases they have counter magic to back up all the things they're doing as well. So
sure.
It's one extra thing that you have to fight through to stop this slow deck that's accumulating resources without actually necessarily winning the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And honestly, another example that I'd put down when we were putting this show topic idea together was another commander that also includes blue, which is Shorokai, the Genesis Engine. I mean, that one's also like amazing. That's the vehicle commander that doesn't necessarily need to be built with a bunch of vehicles if you don't want to, but it taps to draw you two cards, discard a card, and it makes a pilot token. And a lot of that deck, I think, it really is focused on like, here's a lot of like game actions over and over again, where you're like untapping it, retapping it to draw cards, discard, untapping it with a whole bunch of other effects, unbender tines and other things like that. And that's a lot of game actions, and you're going to end up with probably a couple of 1/1s, which is really good and really helpful. But again, that's a deck that like might be difficult to pull together a win condition, which is why I think a lot of players have defaulted to finding combos that work with tapping and untapping it over and over again and making a whole bunch of creature tokens like that. I feel like a lot of Shorokai players have kind of found themselves in that niche, because just relying on 1/1s and vehicles is not always a reliable win condition, whereas a combo will actually get you there. But again, yeah, it's a commander that contains blue and is therefore very resilient, especially because it's making you blockers and drawing you a lot of cards.
Well, Joey, you mentioned specific commanders so far. We've done this. I'm going to throw a whole category, a whole strategy, I guess, really under the bus here. Super Friends decks definitely fall into this category of dirtily decks that they take a lot of game actions, they do a lot of stuff, they get a lot of value, but they sometimes can struggle to actually close games out. If you want to talk about a very just time-consuming strategy, you have to be very, very skilled with a Super Friends deck to really know how to play that and not just kind of drag it out. It ends up being solitaire a lot of times, just because there are so many game actions. Not only are you casting all your spells like a normal deck would be doing, but also you also have these planeswalkers on the battlefield that have their own decision trees to play through and resolve. If you have a Jace the Mind Sculptor and you're brainstorming every turn, that's a whole long spell to resolve that you're doing every single turn on your Jace. If you have any given planeswalker, there's just so much to be going on there. Any of the Lilianas, there's just a lot of things you have to consider when you're resolving literally any of those abilities. And man, they can be very time consuming. There's a lot going on. But then when you talk about, okay, well, how does all this value win? A lot of times these Super Friends decks, that takes a while for them to actually snowball to a win.
Even when they ult a Planeswalker, too. Like, even if you get the Doubling Season instantly ult a Planeswalker, mm-hmm. I mean, Planeswalker ultimates are designed not to automatically win the game. You still have to put together a little bit of extra. But, like, there are Planeswalkers out there that prevent damage to you as their ultimate, or that stop people from playing non-creature spells, or that counter the first spell that an opponent plays each turn. Or one, I think there's an Ojani that just gains you 100 life. And, like, those are great when you ult them, and it's going to be, again, really hard to kill you. But, yeah, ulting a Planeswalker is not the end of the game by any means. So even when you achieve the thing your deck wants to do, you still have a little bit more to go. So what is your win condition past that point? Yeah, that's a great example of a category.
And if you want to talk about maybe not winning, but also finding ways to not lose, gaining 100 life is a really, really good way to not lose a game.
Well, like, we play a game or two pretty much every week on twitch.tv/EDHRecCast.
Hey.
And there's a reason I think once ever I've played my Jerry with Eyes Open Super Friends deck on stream, because it is dirtily. And while I admit it's dirtily, I've actually taken a look over the years at like maybe converting that to a different style Super Friends deck. I'd still like to have one. And I've of course assumed mono white is probably the worst way to do it. But every time I look to do that, I then look back at my deck and realize, well, almost all of my planeswalkers in that deck make tokens. And I'm in mono white, so I have access to things like Cather's Crusade and Divine Visitation, and like ways to actually make those tokens kill people. I actually do have win conditions in that deck, and whenever I look to like make it into a different color combination, I feel like there's actually kind of less ways to, because most other colors planeswalkers don't necessarily make tokens.
Oh, wow.
So as dirtily as that deck is, it's still probably less dirtily than most Super Friends decks, oddly enough, considering the fact that it's mono white.
Interesting. That's very interesting. And hey, I'm glad that we found a non-blue example of a dirtily deck. Let's find more of those.
Yes, there we go. Yeah.
Another few that we had written down here would be Thantis the Warweaver. Like, I tried building a Thantis deck. That's the Jund spider that makes all of your opponent's creatures attack each turn, but if they attack you, Thantis gets +1 counters. It took so much to try and make that deck do its thing. And at the end of the day, the thing that I was trying to do was make my opponents attack, and hopefully not me. And that's very hard to do, because it's not goad. It's an effect that they just have to attack. They can point it at you. Do I have enough defenses? They have to set up defenses. And you also have to make sure that your opponents have enough creatures in play that like will be good once you finally get them to attack with each other. is that good for you, or were they going to attack with those creatures anyway? Are you actually causing them an issue or disrupting their game plan when you finally get your commander to do the thing you wanted it to do? So that's another example that strikes me, and not blue.
Well, Joy, you say it's another non-blue dirtle deck. I'm going to go back to blue because I want to throw blue just as many hate balls as I can. So Lynd's Cheerful Tormentor is one that also kind of comes to mind. Lynd's Cheerful Tormentor is that Grixis-colored curse tribal deck, which it's a very, very cool idea. We don't often get Enchantment Matters type of stuff in Grixis colors, but here we are. But also, when you look at the typical curse deck and just what those curse cards are, those enchantment auras that go on players, a lot of times they're getting meaningful, not really meaningful, but like minimal effect, but you're getting it recursively. So you're getting very, very small things. Like whenever you have the curse card, so Curse of Verbosity, whenever somebody attacks the enchanted player, you and that player draw a card. Curse of Surveillance, where at the beginning of the enchanted player's upkeep, any number of target players other than that player draw cards equal the number of curses attached to that player. So you're getting a lot of really cool little effects, but they're not actually doing a whole lot of damage or finding ways for players to lose. It's just more and more value. There are a few that do pretty well when it comes to actually, you know, making people lose the game, but they're kind of few and far between, especially in Grixis colors.
Yeah, no, I feel that. And especially, I feel like there are a lot of curses that don't necessarily like cooperate with each other as well. Like some curses are very attack focused, and then there are plenty of other curses that care about milling your opponents. And it's just like that's chocolate and bacon. Those don't necessarily work together. So you also have to like curate probably an already limited number of curses to even fit in that deck. And even Lynd's own ability actually would probably classify here, where like you're going through a lot of steps to give away a curse to another person, detach it from yourself and give it to someone else so that you can draw two cards. And like, there's a lot of stuff that's involved in all of that. Like you have to usually use stuff like Claws of Gix and things to like try and sacrifice curses that might end up attached to you. And you're putting a bunch of other stuff into your deck to try and mitigate the curses that might fall onto you so that you can buy yourself time to give them away. Also, that you can do the thing of drawing two cards. And that took a lot of effort just for a divination effect is all.
Well, and while that particular deck might not be time consuming in terms of like casting those curses, you've created this board state now where everyone has to remember what cards that don't belong to them are now attached to them or their opponents too. It's like you're creating kind of this mental tax you're putting on everybody else too, which is can slow the game down for sure.
Oh dude, mental tax. I feel like that actually leads us to another category of decks that would also definitely, I probably should have led with this one, but like dungeon decks. Oof. I feel like this is actually a reason that a lot of players don't want to bring the initiative into the game. Like there are a lot of people who will put monarch cards into their decks because they want to put the monarch into the game because it's pretty straightforward. Whoever has the monarchy will draw an extra card at the end of the turn. But I have not seen quite as much attention for initiative getting into regular commander games unless the deck is fully 100% a dungeons deck like Sephiroth, for example. Because if a card says you take the initiative on it and it's like one of your only things, suddenly the initiative on everyone's board, it's a lot to keep track of that not everyone's always in the mood for. You probably want a higher density of initiative stuff to actually care about putting that into a deck rather than the one-off cards like you might see with Monarchs. But even then, dedicated dungeon decks, it takes a lot of going through the dungeon to accumulate a lethal board state as well. That is a lot of stuff you gotta do.
And you're compounding that by the fact that, like, right, you're going through the dungeon one step at a time and no one remembers what the dungeon's individual rooms are. So, like, that's adding a mental tax. And then in that deck, what you tend to be doing is they're doing a lot of blink things or a lot of clone things. There's a lot of, like, additionally dirtily things they're doing so they can generate multiple initiative and dungeon triggers per turn to kind of work their way around the kind of baked in speed bump there to keep you from doing that. So the deck is just encouraging you to do all kinds of dirty things to maximize finding any way to actually win.
Yeah, I think as much as I like Monarch and the initiative as mechanics, initiative kind of misses for me because you're asking people to bring game pieces that they wouldn't otherwise have anything to do with or need to know at all. But if you have initiative, somebody can take that from you and then they also have it. So
yep,
you're kind of asking people to play your deck on a little bit of a scale there. And most people, if they want to play your deck, they're going to play theft decks. They're going to steal your things instead of stealing the mechanics in your cards, which sometimes can be a major miss for some people.
Yeah, if you're playing initiative cards, you should be bringing four copies of the initiative thing so that you can give them to everyone. But, like, make sure that you've brought tokens that they will need. I feel the same way about Grismold players. That's another deck that gives a lot of tokens to other people. Make sure that you've brought a substantial number of plant tokens for the entire table to make sure that they're good there.
Mm-hmm.
But like, on this subject, I think the dungeon decks, especially Sephiroth, stands out here as an example of, like,
mm-hmm.
people have had to get kind of creative with what are the win conditions of that deck going to be. Sephiroth, whenever you complete a dungeon, you get a creature back from your graveyard onto the battlefield. And in the data on EDH Rec, a lot of the creatures that we tend to see as sort of top ends for that ability tend to be kind of brutal, like Elesh Norns and Toxrills, because of how dirtily the rest of the deck is. Like, you've got some standout cards in that deck, like Radiant Solar will take you through a dungeon like three times in a single turn. That card's amazing. But going through the dungeon three times in a single turn does not a game win for you. So something like an Elesh Norn will actually potentially close things out. And that can be kind of jarring as an opponent when you see, oh, I didn't expect that would be the final boss at the end of the dungeon. That's pretty different than what I expected the rest of the deck to do. But, I mean, that deck is looking for a way to close things out, and just going through the dungeon, barring an infinite combo, is not going to do it. And sometimes you need something that is a little bit more brutal at the top end to try and finally close the game down.
Yeah, I would say in the last year or so, the dirtiest decks I've run into have been dungeon decks for sure, and probably in particular Sethra's decks.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can totally feel it. And I don't think that, like, we probably should have mentioned this before. This isn't bad. Like, we've each said that we also have decks that dirtle. Like, it's not a bad thing. It's just a thing to be aware of about your own decks. It's probably a thing we should have qualified earlier. But it's good to qualify it now. Better late than never, right, Matt?
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally late than never. I've never owned a Moldrotha deck, ever.
there you go.
Except that I have. I had a Moldrotha deck, and yes, that was one of the big reasons that as soon as I had a chance to change the commander, I did, because it turned into a case of, I felt like I was taking up more of the player's time than I felt okay with as far as the other three people at the pod. Mm. And that was just an experience that I didn't enjoy for myself or putting other players through. So I changed it up. That was just something that I did not like. I have said many, many times on the podcast, like, I like proactive decks. I like moving things forward. I like turning things sideways, and just Moldrotha was not that deck for me. So instead, that's when I made my Ukima and Khazr deck, and I've had a blast ever since.
And boy, does that one move the game forward, because you can't even block Ukima. And then even if you get rid of it, it still deals like 10 damage to me. And that's a conservative estimate because of how much you buff that thing up. Not that I'm, you know,
it deals 10 damage to you, but it kills Sheldon Mennery whenever he comes on our stream at twitch.tv/EDHRetcast. So that's what really matters.
Let's be real. It doesn't just deal 10 damage to me, because when you attack me with your unblockable Ukima, Dana like gives it plus 10 or infect or a bunch of other
circuit or something for sure.
Exactly. Okay, yeah, this is very interesting. But before you guys have the chance to steal my segue from me, I am going to manually move us now into Challenge the Stats so that we can take a break from the dirtling and we can talk about some cards that are either over or underplayed on EDH Rec. So let's take a break and talk about that.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, I can hop right in here with my challenge of stats then. From way back in Urza's Gears set, the famous Urza's Gears.
Urza Saga, you mean?
Yeah, sure. You know, both names are, has two official names.
Matt, Urza Saga is a land enchantment.
Oh, there we go.
Both of you.
Come on, Matt.
Joey, that's not even
doing
almost as bad as your sauerkraut stains.
Oh, man. Anyway,
one way to make cabbage better is to put it out in the sun. No, so Thran Turbine is a one mana artifact from back in Urza's Gears. It says, during your upkeep, you may add up to two colorless mana to your mana pool, and this mana can't be spent to play spells. It's in 2000x in EDH Rec, so it's a terrible soul ring. Except if your commander has an activated ability that requires mana to use, I ran this a few years back when I had temporarily built a Kenrith the Return King deck, because Kenrith has a bunch of abilities and you generally don't care about when you use those abilities.
Mm.
It's a pretty nice free source of mana during your upkeep, and there's a ton of commanders out there that have activated abilities that it's a very efficient way to pay for those. You know, Zancha Sleeper Agent, for example, just lets you spend your Thran Dynamo mana and one additional land to shock someone and draw a card. There's Grenzo Dungeon Warden putting cards in the bottom of your library. There's a ton of things you can do during that upkeep, and it's a really efficient way to do that. So if you are playing a commander that has an activated ability that requires mana, and the timing is kind of irrelevant, take a look at Thran Turbine. It's really efficient, and it's a very cheap card that doesn't see almost any play, and it should see a little bit more.
I am way into that. That's clever. I really like it, especially for Zancha. Like, oh, that's such a... I just like that commander in general, too. But yeah, Dana, that's a cool pick. I love it. I'll move now to our listener-submitted challenge this week, if that's okay, Matt. I want to make sure that my...
It's allowed.
That I'm not making you sour about the situation.
Make it happen.
What about kimchi? Like, do you like kimchi? Kimchi's amazing. Like, is that okay?
It's spiced, at least, though.
We're never going to. Okay, so our listeners submit a challenge to stats this episode comes to us from Maxwell Nichols. Maxwell actually sent us an email years ago, and I think Maxwell was really on top of something because I've seen a lot of people talking about this online a little bit more recently as well. Wanted to challenge the card Aetherworks Marvel in treasure decks specifically. So Aetherworks Marvel is the 4-mana Kaladesh legendary artifact. Whenever a permanent you control is put into a graveyard, you get an energy. And then you can tap and pay 6 energy to look at the top 6 cards of your library, and you may cast a card from among them without paying its mana cost, and you put the rest on the bottom of your library in a random order. Currently only showing up in 3,700 decks right now. And it is not showing up in a lot of treasure decks, but Maxwell, this is a great pick for treasure decks because those treasures technically hit the graveyard and then vanish, but that will give you a bunch of energy. So you can go through tons upon tons upon tons of energy and then just get free stuff with an Aetherworks Marvel. Like, you will have so much fuel for this card to just give you free spells every turn. And there just aren't a lot of treasure decks that are currently playing it. Jan Jansen, currently only about 6% of those decks are playing this card. Only about 9% of Jolene the Plunder Queen decks are playing Aetherworks Marvel. So yeah, this was an email to us from years ago, but Maxwell, you were definitely on top of it, and this is definitely a very relevant card right now. Sorry that it took us so long to get to your challenge, but Aetherworks Marvel is indeed a Marvel, and I think it would be great for those treasure players. So good shout. All right, Matt, now it's on to you.
Well, my challenge this week is for one of the new commanders, which actually I'm kind of surprised that it's been as popular as it has so far, but is Torwauki the Younger, which Dane and I got to talk about a little bit. Man, it is very, very interesting. I'm excited to see what people are doing with it. So Torwauki the Younger is 3 and Rakdos colors, so a black and a red, for a 3-3 with reach and lifelink. Whenever another source you control would deal non-combat damage to a permanent or a player, it deals that much damage plus 1 to that permanent or player instead. And then also, whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell, Torwauki deals 2 damage to any target. So there's a lot going on here. There's 2 really cool abilities that you can focus in on. And I am a big fan of these ping-style decks where you're able to cast a spell and burn people out, and you get all sorts of cast triggers, the spellcraft or the magecraft abilities. Whenever you cast an instant or sorcery, you get an ability. Mm. So one of the cards that I have always wanted to find a home for, and I think this really could be the place, is Sir Kara the Bold. So Sir Kara the Bold is 3 red-red for a 3-3 human knight that says, whenever Sir Kara the Bold or an instant or sorcery spell you control deals damage to a player, you exile the top card of your library, and you may play that card this turn, and then you can tap Sir Kara to deal 1 damage to any target. So if you're playing one of those more burn-focused strategies in these Torwauki decks, this is an amazing card advantage engine for you because you're able to cast a spell you're going to get a lot of whenever you cast these instant or sorcery abilities. But also, Sir Kara the Bold becomes a card advantage engine. One of the big reasons that burn decks in general don't translate very well to commanders, because the cards and the mana required to actually burn your opponents out as compared to 20 life formats is absolutely huge. The amount of life you have to deal in damage pales in comparison. So every single card, so dealing 3 damage with a lightning bolt, isn't near as impactful as it would be in a modern deck or in a legacy deck. Sir Kara the Bold helps shore up one of the biggest weaknesses that those burn decks would have in Commander, which is where you're going to run out of cards extremely fast. For every lightning bolt or lightning strike that you cast targeting your opponents, you're going to get another card available to you that turn. That's going to help you crank through your decks, and you're going to be able to cast a lot more spells. But also, this combines with a lot of those ping type of cards. You're going to have your Firebrand Archers, your Gutter Snipes. Mm. So not only are you fueling all the burn spells to the face, but you're enabling the rest of the deck to really churn through, and you're going to get so much card advantage. It is a little bit of a deck building challenge, finding the balance between the payoffs and the setup cards. That's one thing we talk about a lot on this podcast. But Sir Kara the Bold is such a powerful engine in some of these decks that I think it should be showing up in so many more decks than it is currently. It's only in 18% of Tor Waukee, the younger decks. And if you're playing the burn-focused version that some people are, you absolutely want this card in your deck.
Well said. That's a very, very fun one. I am into it, and I am scared of it, which is perfect. That's a good line to ride, I think, for a lot of Commander gameplay. That's especially fun for burn. So, yeah, I love it, Matt.
Well, thank you. I you say you're into it, but are you here for it? That is the ultimate question.
I am here for it. Yes. I am. Okay. I'm even there for it. All right, let's move back into our main topic. So I have a question that I kind of want to throw out here as we get into, like, you know, this latter half of the podcast, I suppose, about where do we draw the line between a deck that might be dirtily and a deck that's just bad? maybe I've not phrased that well necessarily, but, like, for example, I used to try to make an Asmira deck, Asmira Holy Avenger, which would get +1 counters equal to the number of stuff that died under your control that turn. And I kept trying and trying and trying until eventually I was just like, okay, I'm gonna give up on this because the Selesnya Aristocrats, is the odds are not in my favor here. So there have been times where I'm like, I think that I might just have to accept that this card, I ran out of patience for it. So, like, Dana, for you, where do you draw the line on, like, this deck is dirtling too much and not, you know, it's just spinning wheels, not going far enough, versus this is not even worth my time anymore? How do you do that analysis in your brain?
That's a good question. I guess it comes down to whether or not I can see potential paths to victory, even if I don't hit them consistently enough, and I at least have some reason to assume I can make that better. So to come back to my most early deck, which would be my Giru with Eyes Open Super Friends deck, well, I will probably continue to get white planeswalkers that make token creatures. So that's an improvement just in terms of, like, being able to swing bodies at people. And one of the things white tends to do is have enchantments that buff up creatures. Well, I'm making tokens, so, like, you know, I will get something else. You know, we got Divine Visitation a few years back. I mentioned Cather's Crusade, Dictative Heliod gives everything +2/+2. There's a handful of those planeswalkers in white that also tend to buff creatures. So, like, there are things in that deck that make me feel like, even if it's a little bit dirtily right now, it's less dirtily than it was 2 years ago, and it will, in theory, be less dirtily 2 years from now. So in the case of that deck, in the interim, I'm cautious with where I play it and with who I play it with, because I know it can tend to be slow. But I also haven't taken it apart because I feel like slowly but surely, either via me tweaking things, I'm making it less dirtily. And I feel like over the course of, you know, the foreseeable future, I will probably get more tools that will make it less dirtily as well, or give me more ways to win games.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that path lighting up in front. I can see you finding those. And so, Matt, what about you? Is it sort of similar, or do you have a different idea on it?
In order for me to consider a commander or a deck bad, I would say the commander is trying to do two things. Either it's too narrow or doesn't have enough support for what it's trying to do. I think Redain, God of the Worthy, is a really good example of something that's just too narrow to be good. Where the big ability is snowlands your opponent's control into the battlefield tapped, and then non-creature spells your opponent's that they cast with CMC 4 or greater cost 2 more to cast. So it's a little narrow to be in the command zone. Hitting snowlands, not enough people are really playing snowlands or snow matters cards. So I think it just kind of falls short. The tax is fine, but it's not impactful enough. Or the other thing that might factor into a commander being bad is it's trying to do too many things at once. Maybe the commander's unfocused, or it's doing one thing, but then it's kind of trying to do a different thing with another ability. And so there's no real direction to that. And maybe sometimes the abilities might even be at odds with each other too. We've mentioned several commanders in the past that what it's trying to do on one axis combats itself, what it's trying to do on the other axis. So those are two big things that I would consider personally when it comes to evaluating, like, is this commander or the deck you're trying to build just bad? Maybe not dirtily, but just it's fighting against itself, or it's just not doing enough, and you're just going to want to look at something else for your commander.
Yeah, I can think a lot of those. Like, there are sometimes commanders to like try and find examples of what you were just talking about. Like, Rigo's Streetwise Mentor came out a little while ago, and that is it's one of the commanders from New Capenna that draws you cards if you attack with creatures that have power one or less. And that is a command, like, that effect is cool, but it is literally restricting what your deck is trying to do. So that would be like, I mean, I'm sure it could find a lot of cool stuff to do with this deck, like attack with a mirror entity and then, you know, buff up everything after blocks have been not declared or whatever, like to reward that so that I get the commander's effect and also can still do lethal. But the commander is putting a restriction down there. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad commander. I think that the payoffs can be worth it there compared to like other examples of like they are too narrow. They don't have enough support. Like Gorion Wise Mentor is another, I think, also Bont commander that cares a lot about adventures that came out in the Baldur's Gate set. And there just aren't a lot of adventures in those colors to really flesh that deck out necessarily. And so, yeah, that could be easily a thing that you run out of patience for. And I would be hesitant to call them bad, maybe still like waiting. No, is that like they have potential, but the potential hasn't been unlocked? They're not the one Neo. Like, I don't know. Does any of that make sense?
I think waiting is a good way to put it, though, because when we first saw in Zendikar Rising, we saw all the Party Matters stuff. Mm-hmm. A lot of those commanders, they didn't really have enough either payoffs for a command or for a full party. You only had one set worth of cards that cared about a party, but also some of the colors were pretty restricted. I mean, if you're playing the Orzhov, you're pretty narrow with the amount of wizards that you can have in your party deck. So it's just, they hadn't really fleshed out the ideas yet. If they made an energy commander, hint, hint, Watsy, then you really only have maybe a set and a half because you have the original Kaladesh block. So you have a set and a half worth of cards to pull from, and there's not enough support there either. I think that definitely is a factor in how long they're waiting for proper support to be, because landfall commanders, every set is a landfall commander supporting set.
Yep, that's absolutely true. And you're absolutely right. There are certain, like, Admiral Beckett Brass did not used to have enough pirates. She has enough pirates now. Dungeons decks did not have enough dungeon stuff, but then the initiative came out and now Sephiroth is actually like pretty supercharged, still dirtily, but has a lot more that it can do. So yeah, those are decks that were just like waiting for their potential to unlock.
So what do you guys do if you find yourself with a deck that you do feel like is in a position where it is too dirtily? Is there any like thing you fall back on? Do you like, I'm just going to put a combo in? What is it you do? Because I can give you an example here. Probably my other dirtily deck is my Glyss of the Traitor deck. It just how it's built and how it plays. I just don't have a bunch of good ways or many good ways at all to win the game. Once upon a time, when I first built it, you know, 8 years ago, the way Commander worked is I could rely on having a 4/4 in play when someone was at 4 life. But like that was a win condition at one point in time. But that's not really how Commander works anymore. So that's the one deck where I'm running overruns, where I'm running Overwhelming Stampede and overrun and things like that, because I'm playing green. So like you can default to that if you're playing a green creature deck. So I have there. That's the only deck where I really run those effects. But is there any kind of go-tos you do or anything you guys do when you're looking to try to find a way to turn a corner with one of these decks?
I would say for me, I just tend to scrap the deck. If I've tried to tinker and play around here and there, I often will just scrap the deck and either convert it, salvage the pieces, or just find a new commander and just take it apart and come back to that color combination later. My Glyss of the Traitor deck, you know, Dana, you and I used to talk about how we would compare our lists back and forth, but mine, I never really got to pan out. It felt like it was trying to do too many things. I couldn't get the balance right, which you've done a much better job than I ever did. And so when I got discouraged with my Glyss of deck, I would tinker with it a little bit, and ultimately I just gave up. I scrapped it. I took it apart. There are other decks that I've done that with where I still will find like 10 cards together. I was like, oh yeah, that used to be in a deck together, and now they're just 10 cards laying in a box somewhere.
This is tough, because I think for me, I have certainly built decks before where I noticed that like I was feeling like, okay, I need to find a win condition that actually like sets things up. But I tend to not want to do combos, for example, like an infinite combo as the way that I'm going to win the game. And I feel like I want to also like clarify right there that there is not judgment from me for people who do use infinite combos to close a game.
For sure.
Because again, I would prefer for the game to end in a timely fashion as opposed to being pecked by a Moldrifter, you know, 20 turns, something like that. Like I appreciate that. And I feel like there are some commanders out there where like, realistically, I'm not going to expect that mono blue wizards deck to deal a bunch of combat damage to win the game, you know? I'm probably going to expect some type of infinite combo, but it's not the thing that I wanted to default to. So what I tend to do is probably like just increase the density of win conditions that I have in the deck, even if I think those win conditions are a little questionable. Like the biggest example of this, I think, comes to me like when I was helping my younger brother build a Kadena deck, for instance. Like that Kadena deck, the precon came with like two cards that were good win conditions, or honestly just two cards that were like win conditions at all. There was an Overwhelming Stampede in there, and there was a Biomass Mutation to make all of your creatures that are 2/2 morphs, or when they flip over, 1/1 creatures most of the time. Like, they're not very big. They don't do a lot of damage. They have crazy cool effects, but there's not a whole lot of them. And we were very tempted. Like, we looked at the Biomass Mutation. We were just like, just probably yank that out there. It's not a good card, right? Oh, wait, no, that's one of the only ways that the deck is actually winning the game. We're not huge fans of it, but we better keep it. And we better find more like that, even if we're not totally crazy about them. So we went for some of the big ones, like a Beastmaster Ascension and stuff like that. But, like, we'll probably, in that deck, we would even just play like a regular Overrun so that the deck has some actual punch. Even if we're not, you know, we compare Overrun versus Overwhelming Stampede, we're not in love with one of those compared to the other, but it's better than only having two total win condition cards in the deck at all. So for me, I think it becomes a density issue. It's a long way to answer that question, but that's, I think, where I've landed.
So did we answer your question, Dan, I guess, is our wrap up
or
there?
Or did we just ramble?
Or how would you answer the question and give an answer? Yeah, turn it around on you, Dana. How do you answer your own question?
Well, so I do think this is the kind of thing where it isn't always necessarily readily apparent what that solution is. Because, you know, these days I tend to brew decks and I tend to have a win condition in mind or multiple win conditions in mind when I brew them.
Sure.
I didn't always do that, but it, just because you didn't do it doesn't mean you can't kind of find it. Like I mentioned with my Jeru deck, I was not intending on winning via token damage in that deck. I just wanted to play mono white planeswalkers because I thought it was funny. And after I played the deck, I then kind of came to realize, oh, well, a bunch of these make tokens. You know, every Elspeth does, a couple of the Gideons do. Mm-hmm. So like, well, okay, I can actually lean into that then. And like, well, there are things in white that care about the small creatures and they can buff those small creatures and care about combat damage. So like, that was something I discovered over the course of playing that dirtily deck. And now I've made it somewhat less dirtily. So that is something you can do. Just because your deck is dirtily right now doesn't mean you can't find those answers just through playing it. You just have to be observant and kind of keep your eye open for those things.
I love that. That's a really, really good lesson, is like letting yourself discover the deck makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Because I identify with you there. Like, I tend to have the destination, like, how is this deck going to win, tends to be one of the impetuses for me to build the deck in the first place. Like, it's no mystery how Conrad is going to end a game. It's no mystery how the Mimeoplasm is going to end the game. It's kind of like right there on the card. And as much as I, you know, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey that matters and the friends we made along the way. When I board a plane, I like to know where that plane is going. I like to know that the plane is going to land. Like, that's kind of my philosophy about deck building as well. So I tend not to run into that issue too much. But it is good to take a step back and do that approach too, where you're allowing yourself to explore, because that is a limitation on my deck building sometimes, where since I already know where I'm going, I don't always give myself time to wander and to enjoy the sights that a deck might surprise me with.
Is this something that you've ever stumbled into, Matt, where like you've built that deck and as you've been playing it, you're like, oh, this is how it wins, even though I didn't realize that?
I would say I have two decks that have done that. My Alila Artful Provocateur deck and my Riel the Everwise deck. Both of those.
Well, both of which could potentially be dirtily if left to their own devices.
Absolutely. So my first realization I had to have was these are control decks. They're not aggressive decks. They're not trying to move the game forward, just because there was a theme that I was trying to set around. But also, I needed to figure out when I needed to shift gears, and that was the biggest thing. So I really had to be patient with just the theme that I took into that deck. Now, Riel, obviously a lot of discarding to trigger her ability, but finding something to do and make sure that all the dirtling and all the value accruing that I was doing with all the sagas in my Alila deck, figuring out when it was time to go and really move things forward, that was a balance I had to kind of juggle around a little bit. I was very happy when my Alila deck finally like took shape, because before it was kind of a good stuff, you know, just playing some artifacts enchantments was very standard. So giving it identity, that was one thing that I think I had to flesh out to find enjoyment in the deck. But then also when I realized like what the deck was actually trying to do versus what I was trying to make it do. A lot of times those are two very, very different things when it comes to playing a deck. I had one idea in mind, but the cards that I put in there were actually pushing in a different direction.
Yeah, Matt, well said. Again, it's like allowing the cards to reveal the stuff to you, or like allowing yourself to understand what it is that the cards are trying to tell you. That now I sound like a psychic. Now I sound like I'm doing like mumbo jumbo music. That's not what I mean. Did any of it make sense? Am I just being silly now? I might just be being silly now.
No, I get what you're saying completely.
I appreciate it, Dana. And you know what? As one final note that I think we probably have to put into this episode, we might need to apologize to all of the Arkalos players that are out there. Because we were talking about Dirtle and not Turtle, and that might have been a thing that we probably also should have said at the beginning of the episode. Like, sorry, meandering Tower Shell, but this episode was not about you.
The Dirtle Turtle is the true offender of this, because it's literally just taking its time.
Right, yeah.
Literally as much as possible. All right, yeah, this is interesting. I think there's a lot of stuff to explore here, and to allow yourself to explore here, and to learn here, to like... Matt, as you like to say, it always comes down to the intentionality. And these are decks that are, you know, it's definitely extra important to be very intentional about the cards that you put into decks like the ones that we discussed today. And there are certainly plenty of other options. So listeners, we would love to know, what are the dirtly decks in your experience? What are the dirtliest decks that you've played? And what were the solutions for that experience in your case? We'd love to hear from you. But with that, fellas, let's call this episode to a close. If our listeners want to get in touch with us, where is it that they can find us all? Matt?
So you can find me on the Twitters at Mathimus55, that's MathimuS55. And don't forget, Wednesday evenings, we're streaming over at twitch.tv/EDHRetcast. We have guests on every single week. It's always super fun. The guests, like, it's just so much fun being able to meet all these awesome people in the community, get to play some games with them. So just make sure you tune in. There's just so much going on there. Can't say enough about it.
Indeed. And Dana.
You can find me on Twitter at Dana Roach. You can hear me on my other podcast, CMDR Central. I'm writing articles for EDH Rec and Commander's Herald. And you can find all of us together at patreon.com/EDHRecCast.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me at Joseph M. Schultz on Twitter. And you can find the cast at EDH Reccast on Facebook and on Twitter. Plus, if you've got a question for us, you can contact us at EDHRecCast@gmail.com. Our thanks go out once again to Chase for assisting me with the post-production of the show. You can find them online at Mana Curves. And listeners, we'll be back at you next week with more data and insights. But until then, remember, EDH Rec your deck before you wreck your deck.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price, and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.